Now we come to the seventh lecture, Dornach, 8th of January, 1924. Rudolf Steiner starts by saying, "My dear friends, today we shall use the first part of today's lesson to answer those questions which have not been considered in the general presentation. And then tomorrow we will continue that which we started yesterday in order to continue the esoteric aspect." Here we have the question. The question is, are there in existence definite exercises in order to strengthen the healing magnetic forces in oneself, and what are these exercises? The Rudolf Steiner answers. Healing magnetic forces are those forces which in the main occur between the ether body of one person and the ether body of another person. Then you must understand that the effect of the so-called healing magnetism rests upon the following. Let us assume a certain person is a strong nature, which means he has the possibility of developing his strong will forces. And he can, under certain Voraussetzungen, certain assumptions, certain predispositions, receive an instruction. For example, I can say to him, if, for example, he suffers from this thing or that thing, I can say the following to him. Every morning at 11 o'clock, you are to think of the sun and imagine that the sun, in the first place, warms your head. That then the warmth of your head passes over to your upper arms, to your lower arms, to your hands, so that you, through it, can really make strong your real force. And then, when you have strengthened your real force, you then attempt that which you perceive of your illness condition to mentally represent it for yourself very clearly. Have a clear mental representation of it. And now, through the force of your will, you can vague shove it, create it away, push it away. Now, it can happen. I say it can happen. It must not happen, but it can happen. Now, these things are almost always problematical. It can happen that if the illness is not united or connected with a special damaging of the organ, in which this organ damaging naturally can expand itself upon all the four members of the elementary body, the solid, the liquid, the egg, the gas, and the warmth. Because if your illness is not connected with some sort of organic problem, then the procedure which I've just described can really help. Of course, in that case, the following has happened. The person in question, insofar as I have given him this instruction, has received a stimulation, an Anregung, a stimulation for his astral body. My instruction, which he has carried out, this Vorstellen of the sun, the warmth in his head, and so on. This instruction, which he has carried out, which has strengthened his will, that has worked upon his astral body. The astral body has worked upon his ether body, and his ether body then, in turn, has worked in a healthy way upon his physical body. And this damage, which was not a deep organic one, has been equalized. It has been he was able to paralyze this damage. Now, you should not say, you are not permitted to say, that such healings are able only to proceed by that which is, according to the today's medicine, called functional disturbances, as contrasted with organic disturbances, in which a real disturbance of a real damage, a real disturbance of the organ is concerned. This distinction which is made between the functional and organic diseases is quite inexact. You can't really say where the functional damages end and the organic damages begin. Functional damages are always small organic damages, which are not able to be proven by today's coarse means in physiology and pathology. You see, in such a case, you do not turn to healing magnetic forces. You appeal to the self-healing of the patient. That is always, under all circumstances, if it is possible to be applied, the much better path. Through that, you strengthen the will of the patient. You make the patient's will stronger insofar as you make him healthy. Well, I'm afraid in this last part, Rudolf Steiner's confused me. I've translated exactly as it's there, and I'm a little confused, but perhaps you may make better sense of it than I'm making. Now, Rudolf Steiner continues, you can also make the following. Now, without trying to make stronger the will of the other person who is to be healed, you can, from your own astral body, influence your own ether body in this way, in such a way that your own ether body can so work upon the patient's ether body as previously the astral body has worked. Now, this is what constitutes the healing magnetism. The healing magnetizer does this unconsciously. He influences his own ether body from out of his own astral body. The forces which he then develops, he can then instinctively direct them in such a way that they strengthen the force of the patients insofar as he transmits these forces to the patients, to the patient. You must be clear about the fact that when you are concerned with the healing, the magnetiseur, the one who does the magnetizing, must apply that which can lead to the healing. When you're dealing with a patient who is simply too weak, in whom you can't really expect anything in reference to his own will, in that case, you can also apply a healing magnetic force. Now, I believe I can understand now what I couldn't understand before. I would put it this way. You can take two types of patients. First, a patient who has not the possibility of strengthening his will, another patient whom you can strengthen his will. In that case, what you would do as a healer, you would work with your own astral body and give him instructions, in other words, impart to work on his astral body, then through his own instructions, he is able to strengthen his own etheric body, and that causes a healing. Now, that's not magnetic healing. Now, magnetic healing occurs when you yourself use your own astral body to strengthen your own etheric body, and then from out of your etheric body, you pass over forces to the patient's etheric body, and then he gets cured. Now I can understand what Rudolf Steiner is driving at. Rudolf Steiner continues, I would like especially to emphasize the fact that healing magnetic forces are really something rather problematical. In one case and in another case, they are not equally applicable. This instinctive capacity, namely what I've just described, where one puts one's own astral body in activity and then influences the ether body in order to be able to find the transition into the ether body of the patient, this instinctive capacity is an individual one. There are people who have it very strongly, there are those who have it very weakly, and there are those who don't have it at all. So that when you have a good, well-capable healing magnetizer, that is because of his own capacities. But the significant thing is this, that this capacity, as a general rule, is a zeitlich begrenzte, a time-limited one, such predisposed healing magnetizers have this magnetism, as it is called. Now, insofar as they begin to apply this force, it works very well. Then after a time, it doesn't work so well. And you reach the point quite often in healing magnetizers that through the fact that the capacity has weakened, but then they try to give the impression they still have the power, and as a result of that you get charlatanry. This is a very doubtful thing every time when you call into action the process of healing magnetization. The very doubtful thing occurs when this healing magnetization becomes a profession, because the very important factor involved in healing magnetization is a real love towards the patient. And you can't exercise this real love when you have it as a profession. And then you have the question that of karma. Sometimes karma is able to drive a person in such a way that he can help someone else in a way filled with love. And you have a case when you have the external indications, the laying on of hands or the stroking. Then what works then is that the astral body passes over its force to the ether body, which works on the ether body of the other person. It is also necessary to say from the other side what occurs in such a situation. It is so that the healing always proceeds from the astral body, either from one's own astral body or from the astral body of the magnetizer. Now, the reverse process is at the base of the medicament therapy. In medicamentous therapy, you do nothing else but that. You bring substances into the physical body, which then impart inner forces, so work in part on the rhythm of the physical body, that the ether body of the patient is influenced. The health process always proceeds from the ether body. That in one case you influence the ether body from the astral body, that is the psychic healing to which healing magnetism occurs, but to which, with that, there is something problematical. or purely, I might say, something humanitarian, something of a social nature, something which includes the relationship from person to person. You have this psychic healing on the one side, or on the other hand, you have the rational therapy, and this must proceed from the ingreifing, the insertion of medicaments. And these, in the first place, go down out of the ether, out of the physical body, into the ether body. But always, the healthing process, the health process, must proceed from the ether body. It is completely fantasy to say that the physical body, when it's become that you can exert some kind of healing into the physical body when it's ill. The physical body has the causes of illness in it. The causes for healing must always proceed, come from the ether body. Now we have the next question. The question is, what connections occur between the heart and the female uterus and its position, and the soul experiences of pain and joy? Now, I wonder why this question is a rather peculiar question to me, but I expect, not being a doctor, I wouldn't understand what he's talking about. But there's the question. I just said it now. Anyway, Rudolf Steiner answers. There do exist direct interconnecting, there do exist there interconnecting experiences. In the first place, even though the heart and the uterus are not in direct physical contact, they are all two organs which belong together in such a way as the sun and the moon. The sun and the moon belong together so that they both throw the same light upon some external object. In the first case, the sun works directly upon the object, and in the other case, on the bypath, insofar as it first goes to the moon and then is reflected back. The organ of the heart has a direct impulse for the human organism. It is the organ of perception for the blood circulation which proceeds in the normal human organism. The female uterus is constituted to the fact that it is the perceptive organ for the circulation which is called forth after conception. That's what it's there for. It's precisely so that just as the moon reflects the sunlight, so does the female uterus reflect the perception of the heart in the blood circulation. It reflects it back. They always belong together as sun and moon, insofar as their perceptions relate themselves as direct in working and reflected in working. When a person already is in existence, he needs the force of the heart. But when the person is in the process of developing, he needs the reflected heart force. And this comes from the female uterus. Now, these organs, with several others, the lungs lead over more to the etheric physical body. These organs, heart and female uterus, are nothing other than physically that which, viewed from the spiritual aspect, are the soul aspect of the human being. Looked at from the spiritual, the heart and the female uterus as physical organisms can be regarded as the Seelische, the soul aspect of man, the soul aspect of the human being. I believe Rudolf Steiner mentioned in this sentence that the lungs are also the soul aspect, but they lead more down to the etheric physical body. I wonder if he's saying that he's looking at the heart and the female uterus as physical organs, and then he's making the contrast between, as far as the lungs are concerned, you must consider them more as passing over into the etheric physical body, and the lung in that respect is also the soul aspect from the spiritual point of view. I really don't know. In fact, I wish he hadn't brought the lung into this, because he's confused me. Now Rudolf Steiner continues. Now I can say it in the following way. Just think of the fact that you develop imaginative knowledge. When you develop imaginative knowledge, so you receive, when you look at a person, actually you receive the picture of sun and moon when you look upon the heart and the uterus. That is factually the corresponding spiritual that the human being experiences in his soul, so that really the heart, what the things that proceed in the heart and the uterus really correspond to each other, and which, to be sure, proceed in the half unconscious aspect of the Seelische, because the Seelische, the soulish, otherwise is influenced by thoughts. And because the soul is influenced by thoughts, so there is covered over a finer process, namely the inward connection of heart and uterus. The person who only in a small way can observe a little, he can observe how so much immensely depends on how half unconscious, or half conscious I might say, the heart activity must develop itself under the inworking of the physical environment. The person who so carries his life that he continuously receives a shock, let us say through his profession, he already has in his unconsciousness quite precisely a soul Ebenbild, a soul picture, identical picture, a soul reflection, Ebenbild, of the heart activity which there arises, and that reflects itself in the uterus. We are able to see how that occurs and how that passes over to the constitution of the embryo. Now, this is a question which is very difficult to answer, because it must be answered in a superficial way. Thus, you can just merely impart something. Or, on the other hand, you have to fundamentally, intensely go into the question, how does the carrying of pearls and no edelstein, precious stones, work upon the single organs? Now, I can't see why Rudolf Steiner brought this in suddenly, but we'll find out why he suddenly brought this up. I can't see the connection. Anyway, Rudolf Steiner continues. It does work, but it works so that one can only actually judge the way of working when you look into the spiritual world, and that one is only able to judge in an individual way the way it works. One can very well say, for example, Saphir works upon a certain temperament, upon a choleric, but actually only in individual case. Workings are already there. But when one asks the question, if you want to answer the question deeply, then you must go much more deeply into things than is here possible. Now, Rav Steiner continues, and what has happened here, and the public, and the book, the German book, didn't make it clear that this, that he talked about the working of precious stones upon single organs, that's a different question entirely. He'd already finished with the question of the heart activity, of the uterus and the heart. Now Rudolf Steiner again goes into another question. He says, evidently somebody asked him a question about how one can receive insight into the single illnesses in reference to karma. He says, I can only answer that question from what I've already said in the lecture. And perhaps I might speak more about it. Now he continues, now here are some other questions, and these other questions I believe can really be answered when I talk in a more esoteric way. Now, here's another question. Do there exist valid parallel connections between the degree and the time, the lasting time, the time of lasting, of post-mortal processes of verwesung, decay, and the destiny of the individual himself in the spiritual world? Rav Steiner answers, connections which really have a significance and which really concern us human beings do not really exist. It is so that, to be sure, the process of decay is not merely the physical process which chemistry normally regards it. With it, a much deep spiritual is connected, and this was felt in the ancient instinctive knowledge. For example, in the word verwesen, the German word for decay, you say that the inner kernel of something is the wesen, and the pre-syllable ver, V-E-R, verwesen, the ver aspect, always signifies the moving of oneself to something. Now, to use an example, Dr. Steiner uses the word zucken. Well, the German word zucken, as I see here in the dictionary, means jerk, move convulsively, twitch, quiver, wince, flicker, flash. That's what zucken means. Now, Rudolf Steiner says, when you, for example, say zucken, so is that a movement. When you say verzucken, now the German word verzucken means exercise in rapture. So Rudolf Steiner says, when you say verzucken, that is a hinbewegung, a movement towards zucken. So when you say verwesen, that is a hinbewegung, a movement towards wesen. Wesen means being, a going, an aufgehen im wesen, an absorption in being. Man is not this abgeschlossene Wesenheit. Man is not just this closed in being. There are spiritual beings which create within the human being. We have certain beings in the physical, in the etheric, in the astral body. We have beings in all these. We have beings in the physical, etheric, and astral body. But only in our ego organization are we free. The beings which are united with the physical, the etheric, and the astral body, they are united with that which precedes after death with the physical body. And inwardly connected with that is the question of Verwesung. There's connected to that the question of Verwesung or Einäscherung, with putrefaction or cremation. But all these things are inwardly connected with the human karma. One can only say that for man as such, for the individual human being, the question has actually not an unbedingt großer Bedeutung. It has not an absolute great significance. Now the next question, Rudolf Steiner reads the next question. Is the section from a certain point of time after death on an influence or on the destiny of the dead person? The German word section means autopsy, dissection. And the questioner evidently means he wants to know if you have an autopsy on the dead person, does it influence the death person? Rudolf Steiner answers, that is quite without influence on the destiny of the death person, of the dead person. Rudolf Steiner continues, most of these questions are such as can be answered in the general lectures. Ah, he says, now indeed, there's still a question which has a certain importance. And now he reads the question. I want to know, are the healing capacities of the doctor purely of a personal nature, or are they conditioned through a community connection? This means not through a community connection between doctor and patient, but through the community of doctors. Is it possible that the single patient, that to the single doctor, forces can flow from such communities, just as it occurs in the community of priests? Now, this is a very funny question. Anyway, see what Rudolf Steiner says. Rudolf Steiner answers, that is indeed the case, only it's also the case in every human Gemeinschaft community. It is in every human community so that out of the community forces flow to the human being, only that the community must be a real community, Gemeinschaft. You must feel it, you must perceive it and experience it. And that which I have described to you, and I will still describe to you in more significantly tomorrow, that is in the main so that it, between you and us, together, there can be formed a Gemeinschaft, a community, even if in the first place it can only be a community by correspondence, correspondierende. This should so unite you that when you are alone, you will be able to feel that to you, through such a community, not only upon intellectual paths will forces flow to you, but forces which will flow to you on spiritual paths. Now it goes to the next question. The training of the gaze for the doctor. Have iris diagnoses, graphology, chiromancy, that's palmistry, have these any worth? And Rushana answers, now, in ideal cases, there would be that which one can observe with a connection. For example, out of a small piece of the fingernail which you can't cut off, a great deal of things can be learned about the total condition of the human being. That is really thoroughly possible. Just as much as you can learn a great deal out of a hair of the human being. However, you must remember how individual these things are, how different, for example, a hair is in relationship to a human being. Just think how human beings in relationship to their hair differ among themselves. Among you in the audience, there are blondes and also there are dark people, schwarze are under you, people with black hair. What's the cause of that? Those of you who have black hair, the blackness of the hair comes from an iron process which occurs in the hair. Those of you who are blonde have your blondness from a sulfur process which occurs in the hair. A sulfur process which is particularly strong in the people with red hair. And it is to be noticed that these things have an extraordinary great interest. I have really known people about whom one can say the following. It means something that they are fiery, they were fiery in their sparkling red hair. There occurs an extraordinary strong real sulfur process, whereas black hair has a relatively strong iron process. Now just think about the fact that that is the outflow of the whole human organization. One case you have a human being who is such that he continuously produces something which is of an intensive combustible material, sulfur, and so that he permeates his hair with it. In the other case, he separates something which is iron, which doesn't at all burn, which is something else. And through that, you have indications of a very deep-seating difference between both human beings in relationship to their whole organization. Now that which is a very coarse situation in the general, and that which as a general rule is of ganz grob, coarse, that is individual in every human being in reference to his hair, so that you can able to learn about the total Beschaffenheit. You can learn about the human being from the way his hair is constituted. That is the case. Is it not possible that you will be able to learn something out of the Beschaffenheit, the composition of his iris? But you must realize that to these things there belongs the highest knowledge, not that blödsinnige Erkenntnis. Blödsinnige is a naughty word, I think. That terrible knowledge with reference to the iris which the diagnosticians have. That is naturally dilettantism. Precisely on these things, they rest upon a real foundation. Leads the path to the final point, to a true knowledge, just as the path of astrology leads to spiritual knowledge, whereas previously it is frightfully dilettantish. And the same thing goes for palmistry and graphology. As far as graphology, you need to have a real inspiration. When a person writes, that is of a quite individual nature. about that to the highest degree you might give an instruction. But these instructions are then extraordinary coarse. Also there, it's necessary what I've just said. There it is already necessary to have inspiration in order to be able to conclude something from graphology about the human being. Now, with graphology, the specific thing is that out of the handwriting of a person of the present, you can deduce the condition which he was approximately before 7 years, of 7 years ago. And so you arrive at the fact that the person who wants, that he who wants to conclude about the present situation of the human being must again make a bypath. He must be able to pass through the whole development. He arrives at the inner conditions before seven years ago. Then he can look at that with what was perceived, what was 7 years ago. He can then make the path and receive a more fundamental knowledge than he otherwise would have. Thus, it is really possible to do something in that path. Very similar with what is concerned with the hair and the iris is also the situation with palmistry. But again, there you must have inspiration, not the superficial rules which are generally given. You have to have a special anlager, a special predisposition, which some people have, in order to be able to investigate the lines of the hand. They also are intimately connected with the human development. All you need to do is to compare your own hands, how the lines look upon the left hand and how they look upon the right hand. Now, in actual life, in coarse life, human beings write with their right hand. They don't write with their left hand. There's a distinction. In reference to the lines of the hand, it is so that that one can see in the left hand the whole karma of the person, if you are inspired to it. Means if you have the power of inspiration. In the right hand, you will see the personal Tüchtigkeit, the personal skills and proficiency which the human being has acquired in this life. His destiny has created his present life. His proficiencies will lead him into the future. Now, all these things are not without foundations, but it is extremely dangerous to present these things, to do these things in public, in an open way, because there we are treading domains where earnestness and charlatanry in the highest degree border each other. As I mentioned yesterday, in the medical profession, the very significance, the moral soul conditions are very important. Remember, I told you yesterday that the real knowledge about a medicament takes away from the person who knows it the power of healing himself. That precisely in the knowledge of the medicament, also there is something through which the person excludes himself from healing through these means. Now, naturally, the pure chemical knowledge doesn't exclude it, because that's no knowledge at all. But in the case of real knowledge, you have this exclusion process. Rudolf Steiner is referring to the fact that in the last lecture he talked about the fact that the doctor can't use for himself the medicaments that he uses for other people. I mean, the way of healing, whatever that might mean, which I mentioned last time, I really couldn't understand. But maybe he's going to explain it now. Who knows? And it continues. Just consider the following. The muscle system of the human being, that is grasped through imagination. That is cognitively grasped through imagination, as I said yesterday. You learn what works in the muscle insofar as you pass over to Bildhaf picture imaginative cognition. If you want to know what can work in a muscle type of organ in a healing way, then also the therapeutic knowledge must be of an imaginative nature. The true knowledge of an inner organ is inspirative. These are real knowledge, not the chemical knowledge. But let us assume that you know that some sort of medicament works upon the human muscle system in a certain way. You have acquired this knowledge on an imaginative way. Indeed, but imaginative knowledge, that is not like that knowledge which one normally conceives of. The knowledge which one normally conceives of, that doesn't go very deeply in the human being. That is actually effective only in the head. Whereas that imaginative knowledge, which at the same time, whereas every imaginative knowledge at the same time takes hold of the muscle system of the human being. Also, the therapeutic imaginative knowledge, my dear friends, is so that you spur them, you perceive this knowledge in your muscles. Now, you must take such things really earnestly. Now, I must, in order to make it understandable for you, to speak about this thing and to mention something of a very paradoxical nature. But, however, the paradoxical nature is hereby the truth. My book, The Philosophy of Freedom, has been little understood because the people did not understand how to read it. They've read it just like any other book. But My Philosophy of Freedom is not meant like other books. My philosophy of freedom lives in the first place in thoughts, however incorrectly experienced thoughts. Those non-experienced thoughts, those abstract logical thoughts which one today in general has in science, that is experienced in the brain. Such thoughts which I have expressed in my book, The Philosophy of Freedom, now comes a paradoxical thing, one experiences as a whole person, als ganzer Mensch, in his bone system, correctly as a whole man in his bone system. And still something more paradoxical I'm going to express now. This naturally, it's self-understood, has occurred, but you have not observed it because you have not brought it into connection. When those people who have understood my philosophy of freedom, for those people who have understood that, they have quite often in the course of reading it, and particularly when they were finished, these people have dreamed of the skeleton. And this is completely connected moralisch with the whole Stellung of the philosophy, the whole relationship or the whole place of the philosophy of freedom in reference to the freedom of the world. Freedom consists in the fact that one continues to move from the bones out of the muscles of the human being. You move in the external world from bones out of the muscles. No, from muscles out of the bones. You move the muscles of man to move in the external world. You move the muscles out of the muscles, the bones. I'm sorry, I'm confused. I can't get this. Let's say freedom consists in the fact that you move. Okay, I'll continue. Rudolf Steiner says, the unfree person follows his drives and instincts. The free person directs himself according to the demands of the world, which he in the first place must love. He must win a relationship to this world, and that expresses itself in the imagination of the bone system. Inwardly is the bone system that which experiences the erlebt and the experienced thoughts. Thus, experienced thoughts one experiences with the bone system, with his whole human being, namely with his whole actually earth-solid man. There are people who wanted to paint pictures out of my books. They have shown me all sorts of things. They have wanted to express in a picture form the thoughts of the philosophy of freedom. When one wants to paint its content, you must produce dramatic scenes which are led out of the human skeleton. Just as freedom itself is something in which one must completely eliminate everything of an instinctive nature, so is that which the human being experiences, insofar as he has the thoughts of freedom, he has something in which he must eliminate his flesh and blood. He must become skeleton. He must become earthly. The thoughts must really become earthly. And that signifies something out of which one must work oneself out. I've told you all this in order that you should see that by ordinary thinking, ordinary thoughts, something occurs in which the whole human being is taken over, is a griffin, is gripped. When you proceed from thoughts to imagination, so one experiences his imagination in the muscle system. One experiences inspiration insofar as one participates with the experience of one's own organs. You must only not there, you must not, when you're dealing with inspiration, you must not forget the proposition which says the following, and there's Latin, which I don't know, but I'll read it to you. Naturalia non sunt turpia. Whatever that means, you find out. Professor continues, since under circumstances are the most wonderful inspirations experienced with the kidneys or with the other lower organs, but that which is of a higher knowledge, that takes the whole human being in Anspruch, takes hold of the whole human being. And that person receives no impression of imagination and inspiration who does not know that imagineren is a work which is very similar to the physical work, because you strengthen the muscles, so that a real imagineren is a real physical work. Hence there exists a correlation between a physical work and imaginieren. Example, if I'm permitted to mention something personal, I have always found that a great deal has contributed to my process of imagineering in the fact that I, as a boy, have hacked wood, have had to take out potatoes from the ground. I had to work the earth with an earth spade. I have had to do seeding and so forth. All this has contributed a great deal to my power of imagineering. Has made it much easier, the Wiederaufbringung, the bringing it up again in the muscles, the strengthening, it's much made it easier for my imagineering process than it would otherwise have been. So it is, if you have strengthened your muscles precisely in your youth, if you later want to imagineering. But you must see that that's not much value when you have movements which are not work. Actual play doesn't really help for imagineering. Now, I have nothing against play. You have to just study my pedagogical, my educational lectures, and you will see that I have nothing against play. However, the process of imagineering brings the resting muscle to a similar experience as a real physical work. More this, you see, the knowledge of therapeutical things takes hold of, grips hold of your muscle system. And that will be something which has a significance in your karma. Now, let us take, for example, what I want to do now is to construct an ideal situation. Let us take the true therapy of Schwarzen Pocken, black smallpox. The real black smallpox calls forth a very strong inspiration together with intuition. And that which you really know upon this path, in this way, my dear friends, if you are real therapeutes upon this domain, that works stronger upon you when it is a real knowledge. It works much more stronger than an impfung, than an inoculation. It works in another sense much stronger. And you will, in the studying of smallpox therapy as a medicine, as a doctor, in yourself be able to work a kind of healing, a prophylactic. And in this way, you will be able to be adapted when you understand the connections without fear and in complete love to go among the people who have smallpox without having to inoculate yourself. But all these things have, again, their reverse side. They have their reverse side. Because that which one acquires as a knowledge of Heilmittel, of medicaments, that is so when it is real imaginative or inspired knowledge. It doesn't need to be one's own imagination, only, but one which an imagination which another person has, and that everyone can have, as I have always repeated, that is a real Heilmittel. What the knowledge you acquire from imaginative or inspired knowledge, that is a real medicament. The knowledge is Heilmittel. That has healing forces in it. Just the ideas that you have about a medicament, that's effective. But it is only effective as long as you are without fear. Fear is actually the opposite pole of love. If you go into the room of an ill person with fear, so the whole therapy which you have acquired doesn't help at all. On the other hand, if you go into this room of the ill person with love, if you completely forget yourself, if you can take your whole soul and apply it upon the person whom you have to heal, if you're able to live in your imaginative, inspired knowledge, when you enter as a person who is not carrying fear, but as a person who is carrying love of what, in what you know, all this can place itself into the process of healing, so that that not only from the outside medicine into the moralisha, but also from the inside. In the realm of medicine, you are driven into the moral aspect, not only from the external, but also from the internal. And so it is precisely on the realm of medicine, to a higher degree the case, which upon all cases, all domains, when you are dealing with spiritual knowledge, the situation is the following. One must develop mut, courage. You know, mut, courage, is that which is surrounds us everywhere. We are surrounded by mut, courage. Luft, air, is illusion. We're not surrounded, it's illusion that we're surrounded by air. We're surrounded everywhere by courage. If we want to live in the world in which we breathe, we need courage. If we are cowardly in any certain way, we do not live with the world. We exclude ourselves. We are only breathing apparently. That which above all you need for your medical study, that is courage, mut, heilmut, the courage of healing. It is factually so that when, in reference to an illness, you have the courage of healing, that is already the correct orientation, which also, even in 90% of the cases, can well lead to the correct thing. It is namely so that simply with the process of healing, these moral qualities are united in the most inward sense. Therefore, the following should be the situation. The first course for medical students, that which I have already presented in the first three lectures. In the first three lectures, I have created a basis, more or less, through the knowledge of nature and the knowledge of the human being, cosmic knowledge and human knowledge. Now, in the second course, you should have the esoteric deepening in the way of working of the medicine forces, to look upon medicine in the way in which I spoke in the fourth lecture and in the way in which I will speak tomorrow. Then there must be a last course in which in the main will proceed with considering therapeutic aspects in connection with the development of the correct doctor moral capacities, since one must be able to carry the other. If there exists such a moral qualification aspect in the last medical course, then will become actually illnesses for the doctor, the opposite of that which they are for the patients. They will become something which he loves, but he doesn't love them in order to hague them and foster them, to foster them in order that the ill person can remain ill as long as possible, but which he loves because he acquires the illness in its real meaning if it is to be healed. Because illness acquires its real significance only when it has been healed. Now, what does that mean, Rudolf Steiner asks? You see, my dear friends, to be healthy means to carry in oneself these spiritual qualities, the so-called normal soul spiritual qualities to carry in oneself. To be ill, to have some sort of illness, means, however, to actually be influenced by a spiritual quality. Now, I know naturally, when some kind of clever person of the present age will hear what I have just said, he'll say, "Ah, now we get the old teaching of possession." However, to respond to that, the real question is, if the old teaching of possession is worse than the new teaching of possession. When one is possessed by, if it's worse when one's possessed by spirits, or one's possessed by bacilli. That's something, the value of which you can only understand after you investigate it. The modern doctors, they deal always in their medical teaching with a Besessenheit, a possession aspect. Only their understanding teaches them to consider a materialistic Besessenheit, possession. But it is so that when a person has an illness in himself, one has a spiritual quality in oneself which is not there in the usual life progress of the human being. Nevertheless, it is a spiritual quality. Again, I must express a paradox. Let's assume you want to learn about the connection, and it's a quite real connection about which I'm going to express myself. If you want to learn the connection between that which is in the zodiac, Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Cancer, Leo, Virgo, Libra, Scorpio, Sagittarius, Capricorn, Aquarius, Pisces. Now there's a colossal difference between these seven constellations, Sternbilder above, and these five Sternbilder constellations below. Diagram, and the seven on the top start with Aries and they end with Libra. Now, if you rise up to imagination, so you receive for these seven constellations here in the cosmos a being which appears masculine, and for these five constellations below, a being which appears feminine. So actually, male-female spreads itself out in imaginative vision into an enclosed serpent form around the zodiac. But this imagination no person can receive unless he makes the following, unless he passes through, experiences the following. Just think of the illness of smallpox. It shows itself among symptoms of the physical body. But imagine that one would be in a position to do the following. Imagine yourself standing before you, a smallpoxed human being, that he would be able in his astral body and in his ego organization to have the force of being able to draw out the whole of the smallpox illness and only to experience it in his astral body and ego, so that in the moment his physical and ether body would be healthy. Assume hypothetically that it was so. What I've just presented here cannot occur. But if you want to have the imagination, if you want to have this imagination, you must be able, without your physical body and ether body taking on this smallpox illness, you must be able to experience what I have hypothetically presented with the smallpox illness. You must be able in your astral body and your ego body, ego organization, to experience the smallpox illness free from the physical and ether body. Which means you must be able spiritually to experience a spiritual correlate of the physical illness. The smallpox illness, my dear friends, is the physical upbuild reflection of the condition in which the ego organization and the astral body are when you have such an imagination. Now you're able to see into the fact that there occurs in the case of the smallpox illness in the human being itself this influence, out of which in spiritual knowledge becomes heaven imagination, the imagination of the heavens. Now, I hope you can understand all this. I mean, I'm just getting a bare idea of it, but perhaps you can understand it better. I believe we'd all understand it better if he made it much shorter, not so ponderous. He just goes on, and he ties you up in knots, and I'm sure it could be presented much simpler. God bless you. God bless me. Now, Rudolf Steiner continues, now you see how closely connected is the illness state with the spiritual life, not with the physical life. How closely related is the illness with spiritual life? The illness is the physical imagination of spiritual life, of the spiritual life. And because the physical imagination is there unrightfully, while it is not supposed to imitate certain spiritual processes, for that reason, in the physical organization, that which in the spiritual world, under circumstances, is of a highest nature, under other circumstances, is illness in the physical organization. One must be able to grasp the illness in such a way that one says to oneself, if it were not able, through certain things which we will tomorrow look into, if it were not able for certain spiritual beings to be brought down into the place where she does not belong, so they would also not be in the spiritual world. I presume tomorrow in the next lecture he's going to talk about what he means by this. That evidently what he's trying to say is this, that you have certain beings in the spiritual world, and because they're there and they have to be there, and then when they're brought down, you have illness. Anyway, we'll find out in the next lecture what he really means by this statement. Arufsadi continues. With that shows itself how closely connected real spiritual knowledge is with illness. One recognizes, insofar as you recognize the spirit, you cognize the spiritual, then you cognize the illness. You can do nothing else but the following. When ones have such a Himmel's imagination, heavenly imagination, I presume he's referring to the imagination of the zodiac, when one once has that, then you know what smallpox illness is, because smallpox illness is only the physical projection of that which one spiritually experiences. And so, in the main, is the situation with the whole of the knowledge of illness. One might say, when heaven, or also naturally the hell, if heaven or hell too strongly takes hold of the human being, so he becomes ill. If, however, only his soul and spirit is taken hold of, then he becomes a very wise person, or a person who has a lot of insight. Bravo! Now these are things, my dear friends, which you must actually digest in a soul way. Then you'll be able to see the sort of task which anthroposophy has in relationship to the science of medicine, since anthroposophy shows that the correct spiritual Urbilder, that illnesses are the demonic upbuilder, the demonic reflection of correct spiritual primal pictures. That can lead you deeper and deeper into the knowledge which is to be sought upon anthroposophical ground, which is the necessary reform for medical study. And here's the end of the lecture. Now I'd like to give you the summary given by the publisher of this seventh lecture of the 8th of January 1924. Answer of a question about healing magnetism. Answer of a question about the relationship of the heart to the uterus. Answer of a question on the influence of precious stones on the single organisms. Answer of the question about the significance of the putrefaction of the corpse for the dead person. Answer of the question in reference to the significance of dissection in a certain time after the death. Answer of the question on the significance of the community for the healing force of the doctor. Answer of the question about diagnosis through the eyes, graphology, and so on. About healing and the knowledge of medicaments. Of the essential nature of the book Philosophy of Freedom and its significance for the human being. Imagineering and the muscle life, Inspirierung and the life of the inner organs, sketch of what constitutes by Rudolf Steiner for a path of medical study to conform with a spirit type of medicine, a presentation of the nature of illness for the Heilwilligen Arzt, for the doctor who wants to heal. That's the end of the summary. Now, since I'm dealing with summaries, I might as well give you the summary of the next lecture, which is the last lecture of this Christmas course for medical students. And it's the summary of the next lecture, the last lecture, the eighth lecture of the 9th of January, 1924. It's a very short summary. Orientation of the doctor according to karma. The will of karma and the will of the healer. Introduction into the healing, into the leading considerations of healing for the human organism as a result of cosmic forces, in the example of the Saturn and Moon forces. Indications for a meditative deepening.